Yeah, so actually, first I'd like to thank Garrett, who just left, for inviting me to give the talk. And in fact, it's not exactly the talk that I was hoping to give, but I mean, for the reason that, one of the reasons I came to this workshop, because for the past year or so, Sash Newman and myself were thinking about ways to generate spin polarizations in bulk, let's say, Rajput systems. And but without resorting to the edges, which seems to be sort of the conventional way to do that. And at this time, we're pretty much done, but we're not completely done, so I didn't feel that I should put you through the torture of going through the talk, which is not, or work which is not fully finished. But if anybody's interested, I'd be happy to discuss that in private. So this talk still has to do with spins, maybe not with many spins, but just one spin. But nevertheless, I hope to convince you that and by the end of the talk, that there is a lot of interesting physics which is both related to quantum computing, or let's say the hardware part of quantum computing, as well as there is a lot of interesting sort of many-body physics which is involved. Specifically, there is some polaron physics and condo, which we are running into when we are trying to analyze a real physical system, which in our case was essentially a conventional silicon field effect transistor. So that's, I guess, the most important slide, which has to do with acknowledgements. And so these are my collaborators, Timo Mazursky and Matt Hastings at LAML, Sasha Schneumann at Karlsruhe. And so this work wouldn't really exist if it weren't for the our experimental colleague group by Hongwing Jiang at UCLA. And so these are basically the publications which reflect more or less the development of our understanding of the system, which first had to do with understanding conceptually the protocol for whether it is possible to measure electron spin resonance coming from single electron, then the sort of the second half has to do with our attempts to understand the sort of superficially simple, but as it turns out to be at a deeper level, very strange and interesting physics happening in the system that I'm going to describe to you. So here's the outline. First, I'm going to give you just a very brief introduction, or better say, reminder of what the spin magnetic resonance is and how it works. Then we're going to focus on the system of interest, which is silicon field effect transistors. And I'm going to describe to you a very interesting, albeit simple, a single charge effect, which is commonly observed in those devices, essentially commercial device, having to do with a single charge tunneling. And then building upon that charge effect, we're going to sort of propose a mechanism for detection of single electron spin resonance. And I'm going to present you some simple theory and also experiment which shows indeed precisely this effect. Then I'm going to go to the possible applications to quantum computing, how we can, in fact, bootstrap it into the full-blown spin measurement. In fact, I'm going to show you some experimental results there as well, but not coming from our collaborators specifically, but from Leo Covenholm's group, where, in fact, they used essentially the same protocol to measure T1 times for single spins. And then in the second half, I'm going to describe really the sort of the physical nuts and bolts having to do with many-body polaron effects and condo. So first of all, I mean, this is not really a useful slide, but let me go through it anyway. So what are the applications of spin resonance? So at the macro scale, so this is actually quite useful. One can do an MRI, and so the idea there that one can measure concentration of protons, how they move around in a human body, and that's very useful diagnostic. Again, it deals with essentially macroscopic number of spins. Then this is a device where we really scale down in number of operational spins, and this is a dot-to-dot transistor, which I'm sure all of you know and you've already seen many times in this talk. And if we keep scaling down, then we... Yeah, so it should be copyrighted to Dima Mazursky. He came off of this picture. So when we scale down to a single spin, then we really, in the realm of quantum computation, which is quite appealing for many reasons that I don't need to enumerate here. Okay. So this is supposed to give just a very brief reminder of how magnetic resonance works. So what we have here is a electron level which is split by a magnetic field. So in this, the applied magnetic field B0. And I mean, if that would be all that exists, I mean, there would be nothing interesting, no dynamics. The ground state is spin state aligned with the field, excited state, spin counteraligned with the field. Now, if we apply an AC magnetic field, which is transverse to the static one, moreover, if the frequency of the field matches the Zeeman splitting, then we can induce transitions between the spin-up and spin-down states, which are happening at the so-called Rabi frequency, which is nothing else than, I mean, in the units of all the relevant parameters going to one, it is just the amplitude of the AC magnetic field. So this is the idea. That's how it actually looks in practice many years ago. I guess it still looks roughly like this. So there have been several approaches to actual detection of the single electromagnetic resonance. And here, just I'd like to mention a couple. And so this is the cartoon of the experiment which has been performed. So it was done a couple of years ago by Dan Ruger's group at IBM. And what they did, it was really an amazing experiment, tour de force, by all means. And what they did, they detected a force exerted by a single spin on a mechanical cantilever. And you can imagine how tiny this force is. It's basically an atom Newton range. Nevertheless, by applying SMART's spin manipulation protocol, which involved, again, static magnetic field, some microwave magnetic field, they were able to extract the signal. And I mean, data accumulation time was 13 hours for this particular experiment. But they were able to prove that they are sensitive to single spin. And so it was reports in that publication. So this could be called direct spin detection, but in this talk, really, what I would like to focus on is a sort of different approach, which relies on converting spin dynamics into charge dynamics. And so this is basically a representative of this approach, which I'm fond of. And it basically utilizes essentially commercial field effect transistors, silicon oxide silicon, and individual trap, which can trap electron near the interface between the insulator and the conductor. And then what I'll show you is that by applying manipulation protocols to this spin, one can in fact affect the transfer between source and drain, and that way detect the spin resonance. In fact, this publication is 1 week later than the other, and in the same issue, there is also a result by Leo Cohenhoven where they measured T1, but about that a bit later. Again, T1 for a single spin. So, just to give you a brief description of this of the system, to put us on the same page, so this is sort of a theorist view of a field effect transistor, and what it looks like is that we have a piece of semiconductor. We have an insulator. On top of the insulator, we have a gate. And by applying gate voltage, we can control the electron concentration in this inversion layer. So, for example, a semiconductor could be p-doped silicon. And by applying a positive voltage, we can suck up electrons and make this channel into n-type. And then the conductance of the channel is basically monitored by applying voltage to between source and drain, which are these contacts. So these devices are pretty close to ideal, in fact, and very rarely have visible defects which sufficiently detrimentally affect their performance, and that's why our computers work reasonably well. But nevertheless, by applying certain tricks, for example, voltage pulses, etc., or sometimes just by chance, you get defects which are located very close to this interface between the semiconductor and the insulator. And so, for example, here I show an example. Well, I show how this defect can be located on the insulator side, and this is something like a donor atom. And so if this location is close enough to the channel, then the defect can either trap or detrap electrons. Then what happens is that since this device is so tiny, it's could be like 0.2 microns by 0.3 microns. I mean, that's in fact, the device which our experimental colleagues have been using, then even just trapping single electron near the channel can sufficiently strongly affect the source drain current at the level of percent or a few percent. And since this process is random, this results in fluctuations in the source drain current, which people call random telegraph signal. It's not really signal. I'm not sure why they call it signal, but rather, if you like, you can call it switching. Okay, so and that's how it actually looks in practice. And I guess the first experiments that showed this kind of behavior were by Berman and Rouse in the 80s. And so this is a later experiment. And what it shows, indeed, is a behavior of the source drain current as a function of time for various gate voltages. And you see, indeed, that in the range of gate voltages, you see pretty clear bistable behavior, which is most naturally associated with switching between those two charge states of the trap. Now, chemically or structurally, these defects can come from various different sources. They could be dangling bonds, they could be sodium defects, or many others. So this is single charge, but now what really our goal is to understand whether one can do any spin-sensitive measurement using this system. And the claim is yes, and let me explain how. So first of all, let's consider a situation, the most trivialized situation, zero temperature, no AC field. B1 will correspond to the amplitude of AC field, but an applied static field to our system. Then what we have here is basically energy schematic, which includes the conduction channel, this localized level in the insulator, which is split by magnetic field. So this is going to be spin up, this is going to be spin down. And then for this particular arrangement, you can immediately see that if those tunneling rates are small enough, then the ground state will be when electron is just sitting in the trap and nothing else is happening. Okay. But now let's turn on AC magnetic field. So if this AC magnetic field is on resonance with the Zeeman splitting, then we're going to induce, again, Rabi oscillation between spin-up and spin-down states. And then clearly what you're going to see is that for this particular arrangement of the chemical potential, when electron will happen to sit in the high energy state, it can escape. And although this process is still random, you will see that on average, for example, the occupancy of the trap is going to change. Or the time the trap spends in occupied versus unoccupied is going to change. So, and that's the essence of the effect. So it's fairly straightforward. Now, you can do some very reasonably simple quantum mechanics to analyze the situation. I mean, the only non-triviality here is that the situation is non-equilibrium, but otherwise it's fairly straightforward. And the modeling that you can do is essentially Anderson model for the impurity in order to account for possibility of double occupancy, which turns out to be experimentally relevant. And then there are channel electrons tunneling between the channel and the local states, and the AC part, which is here is written, for those who know, in the rotating wave approximation, which is the only relevant part near resonance. So in this coefficient here, Rabi frequency is just the amplitude of the AC field. Okay. So this system can be analyzed. In fact, out of equilibrium, it turns out to be quite straightforward because you don't really run into any issues with condo physics. That turns out to be, at least in the range of parameters, not very important. And so then the way you analyze that is that you derive quantum rate equations, which are essentially block equations for the spin, which in addition to the usual block part, which is describing probability of spin up, probability of spin down, coherence factor, it also includes the probability of this trap to be completely empty and therefore no spin, nothing. Okay, so and that's basically the description that we can arrive to, and one way to analyze this is to look for the stationary states. And so which would correspond to sort of, in NMR language, continuous wave experiment. And so the outputs will be essentially the stationary probabilities for the empty state, up state, down state, or in other words, empty state and the full state. And from that, we can immediately say that the resistivity of the system is going to be the weighted average of the resistivities corresponding to the empty and the occupied states of the trap. So it looks like magnetic resonance, and the result, in fact, is pretty much what you would expect from magnetic resonance. That's that the channel resistivity acquires this additional peak, which is of Lorentzian shape, and essentially then the sort of prescription for experiments would be that you measure resistivity as a function of time, like you, what you typically do, and then you take time average. The time average should correspond to the statistical quantum average, which we produce by doing all this quantum mechanics, and then what you look at is essentially resistivity as a function of applied magnetic field. So essentially, you scan magnetic field and you watch what's happening with this average resistivity. You get a peak. From the position of the peak, you extract G factor. From the width of the peak, you can extract relaxation rates, dephasing rates. Essentially, all the same information that you typically like to extract from a magnetic resonance experiment. Okay. So that's how it looks in reality. Of course, it's not as smooth. So what is shown here is precisely this time dependence of source drain current, and you can see that it is more or less this bistable behavior that, again, you expect to get from this kind of switching to a state fluctuator trap. So the trap is actually quite fast, therefore the structure is a bit more noisy than in the earlier data that I showed you. But nevertheless, so then what we do, we take the average, time average, and plot this time average as a single point, and then change magnetic field, perform the same experiment, plot the time average. And as a result, you get this kind of resonant behavior, and in fact, this resonance really corresponds to, you can extract G factor, and it is this 2.02, which is close to free electrons, but in fact, what is important, what is significant, is that it is not, it's not 2, and it's not 1.999, which could be all the other electrons in silicon. So clearly, it is coming from somewhere else. And moreover, important hint or indication that it is coming from the trap is that this signal is only observed when there is also this random telegraph switching, which is observed in the source drain current.
Why 2.02 tells you that it has to be an impurity? Silicon normally has G factor slightly less than 2.
Yeah. Yeah. So in fact, you can perform electrical detection, well, electrically detected magnetic resonance, electron spin resonance, in those systems. So essentially, you apply microwaves, you apply a magnetic field, and essentially, through heating of the conduction channel electrons, you can affect resistivity. And so there you get G factors, which are significantly different. So the error bars on that are quite small, 0.01. So. Well, it's noisy because it's small, and so I guess the thing to mention here is that ideally you could expect to get a quite significant correction to resistivity, sort of more or less at the level of difference between the filled and empty resistivities. However, here we're working at finite temperature. Moreover, the fact that there is microwaves applied contributes to additional heating, and therefore Fermi surface is not as sharp, there is a smearing, and that all reduces the magnitude of the effect.
So what happens to the noise
of the weather?
Say it again? What happens to the weather?
Yeah, actually that's an interesting point. So here, as it turns out, so one thing to mention here is that this behavior is as far as we can tell, completely consistent with the simple model that I showed you. And you can basically attribute this regime of measurement with sort of weakly perturbing measurement. And there is not really too much which is happening with the random telegraph switching rates, for example. However, and that's what I'm going to show you in a couple of slides, when you crank up microwave power and you, in fact, improve signal-to-noise, there is something really curious which is happening, that the switching rate is getting reduced, which is quite, I mean, completely counterintuitive. We don't understand that. Yeah, there is only one defect which is electrically active, which is switching back and forth. So there could be ones which are deep below Fermi surface or high above, but they don't really matter.
Okay.
that's accidental, it just happens.
Yeah, it's accidental. I mean, there is a certain degree of control you can apply. I mean, for example, if you apply, I can't remember now, either gate voltage pulse or source drain pulse, you can generate those defects, probably by some kind of impact ionization or something. So those would be something like a dangling bond, most likely. But those devices are actually quite nice, and that's why people use them. So in fact, so these ones are commercial ones used for some kind of telecommunication switches. So you don't even need to build them. Hey, it's both good and bad, I guess. So the other experiment that they did was to actually build histograms. So let me explain what I mean here. So you have basically distribution of current values, and so as a result you can analyze it in form of just building a histogram, and you get essentially bimodal distribution corresponding to one or the other charge states of the trap. Okay, and then you can look how the average occupancy, let's say the difference between these guys, depends again on the resonance condition, where you are with respect to the resonance. And again, the same result, that when magnetic field hits the one which corresponds to this applied microwave frequency, which is kept fixed, then you get some signature. But since statistics is more complicated here, signal to noise is not really good. So, of course, I mean, when experimentalists see that something is not very good, I mean, they try to change something, and that's what they did in this case. And that's coming back to your point. What they looked at, essentially the same setup, but they increased microwave power. And as a result, this Rabi frequency is becoming significant, even compared to the switching rate, which is in the millisecond range. And so what they see then is that signal is indeed is very nice, I mean, much cleaner than before. That's again the same change in the occupancy analysis from the previous slide. But the problem is that, in fact, the sign of the signal is opposite from what we would expect. So this is really strange. So clearly, again, the same diagnostics have been applied, and the signal appears only when there is random telegraph switching. But from our simple model, we cannot get the sign of the effect. In fact, there are fairly straightforward, I would say, fundamental reasons why from simple model, as I described to you, this is impossible to get. So that's really something that one would need to understand, either by invoking different orbital levels, sort of going to perhaps more realistic level structure for those defects, which would be already sort of beyond our abilities in material science. So it would be interesting if anybody would be curious in trying to understand this, and I'd be very happy to discuss this. Anyway, but it is resonant, so the frequency scales was frequency scales with magnetic field, so it's all nice and clean, but not understood. So and that's the surprise number one, which we still don't understand. Now, nevertheless, let's take it at the face value and say that okay, so you have the ability to measure single electron spin resonance. Can you actually measure spin, and hence can you actually try to apply this to or try to use it as a sort of machine for quantum computing, piece of hardware for quantum computing? And the answer is yes, in fact. So we came up with this protocol quite some time ago, and our experimental colleagues tried to implement it, but without too much success. And that will be one of the clues for why we need to understand system better. But first of all, schematically. So there is a way to initialize the system essentially to nothing, by raising both Zeeman split levels above the chemical potential. Okay, we can guarantee that electron jumps out, there's nothing there. And then, for example, one thing we can do, or one can do, is to drop both levels below the chemical potential, and then either electron will spin down will jump in, or electron will spin up will jump in, and in general we're going to end up with some kind of wave function which corresponds to a superposition of up and down. Okay, but because of Coulomb, there will be just one electron. So we cannot occupy with more than one electron. Okay, so if we wanted to, we could apply some pulses, or we could initialize it to a particular state. I mean, that's not difficult. But now the Interesting point is actually how you do readouts, and this has been a difficulty for many quantum computing proposals for a long time, and that's why when we figured this out, we were pretty excited, and then, in fact, Leo Covenhoven implemented it quite nicely in the work I'm going to show next. So to read out, you basically do a simple thing. You, again, change your gate voltage bias in such a way that the lower energy state stays below chemical potential and the high energy state goes above, and then you can immediately see what will happen. That if electron jumps out, then really what happened is that we projected this wave function into the spin-down state. And if it didn't jump out, then it means that we project into a spin-off state. So essentially a strong projective measurement. So you could call it collapse if you like. And it will be indeed particularly strong if the tunneling rate is much faster than any other relaxation processes within the system. Okay? So again, our Honglen tried to do this, it didn't work, but in fact, in the meantime, so these are results from Leo Covenhoven's group, where they indeed applied this, it's a very similar system. So this is our, essentially, that's our trap. In their case, it's an island, it's quantum dot. So in our case, we have a channel, they have a quantum point concept. So from the standpoint of physics, I mean, there is no difference. And but they applied this manipulation protocol, and indeed, they were able to see those kind of blips, which allowed them to extract the spin relaxation time, T1. And the measurement efficiency was at the level of 65%, which is actually quite nice. It's not good enough for quantum computer, but it was the first, one could claim, also one of the first measurements of a single electron spin. So they could do it. Then the question is why we couldn't. And so what it really seems to indicate that the relaxation rates within our system, the spin relaxation rates, are in fact quite fast. They are. We could anticipate short relaxation rates because the tunneling is in the millisecond range. So if you do any kind of estimate of the relaxation times based on Karinga, for example, you would get that the spin relaxation times T1 should be also in a similar kind of range. Nevertheless, the manipulation protocols were much faster and still no signal, which indicated that the relaxation, for whatever reason that we don't understand, is indeed much faster for our system, and therefore it doesn't allow us to do this in this experiment efficiently. This past experiment. And so then we started thinking about the details, and the turned out to be that those details are really overwhelming. So it turns out that in this particular devices, so this is again schematic of a relevant part of field effect transistor, that's the gate, that's 2DEC, and that's our defect. One can figure out the position of the defect relative to the 2DEC by doing essentially a capacitance measurement in the following way. That's you vary, so what is shown here is the ratio of the time spent in the occupied states to the time spent in the empty states, and here you just use Boltzmann distribution and you get the following simple expression. So by controlling the gate voltage, you can control this ratio quite sensitively. But now because of the voltage drop between the defect and the 2DEC being just a fraction of the total voltage drop, there is this coefficient of X over D entering, and therefore by measuring voltage depends, we can extract also what this ratio is. Okay, so we know this thickness, we can figure out that thickness. And it turns out that it is really tiny. It's in the range of angstroms. I mean, it's not particularly important whether it's 1 or 5 angstroms or 10 angstroms. The point is that these are essentially atomic length scales. And then whatever you use for tunneling, WKB, overlaps with wave functions, doesn't matter what. I mean, you're going to get extremely fast time scales, which is in tremendous disagreement with what is seen experimentally, which is in the millisecond range, or even second range sometimes. So we need to understand that. And so what we believe is happening is that in fact, one shouldn't think about just a single electron tunneling over this distance, but rather there is a significant precipitation from the lattice, which in fact one could expect on general grounds, because silicon oxide, which is the insulator, is a strongly polar material. So it has negative oxygens, positive silicons, and therefore when you put an extra electron into a localized orbital, the whole lattice relaxes around this charge. And therefore, really, what it's tunneling is not just single electron, but a full-blown polaron. And in fact, you can analyze this this problem with at different levels of complexity. So here again, one more Hamiltonian. Conduction electrons, the localized orbital, the interaction between the charge on the local orbital with this bosonic longitudinal optical mode, Hamiltonian for the optical mode, tunneling between local states and the conduction states. And also, for the sake of argument, we'll suppose Coulomb interaction between the charge on the defect and the electrons in the channel, for the reason that initially we thought that this dramatic slowdown could be due to the essentially X-ray physics, namely that when we populate the trap, all the electrons C has to rearrange, and therefore there could be orthogonality catastrophe and such. Well, this turned out to be not extremely important, so I'm not going to talk about this anymore. But the rest of the problem is, in fact, quite straightforward. So you can apply, essentially, Fermi's golden rule to figure out what the tunneling rates are. And
the question is, this last term, will it be generated by the next last term?
X-ray?
Yeah.
You mean, well, it's a combination. So you need tunneling and you need interactions. Right, so in fact, I mean, this effect turns out to be pretty cute, because this polaron physics in the range of frequencies or range of biases, in a sense, it leads to a slowdown, and X-ray physics leads to algebraic singularity.
I'm asking, but the second order calculation of the second next step to the tunneling term, does that derive the structure of the last term?
Say it again. So if I take this,
the tunneling term.
Yes.
Second order.
Yeah.
Give me something of the structure of the last term.
Well, that's true. But I mean, so this is true. But you could do this perturbation theory if you had again some kind of big denominator, like what you do in Anderson model. Here, this is essentially elastic tunneling that you're looking at. So if I had on-site interaction, if I had Coulomb, then well, to some extent, you generate a Kondo behavior, right? But if I just look at this problem, I mean, it's significantly different, because this is essentially a non-interacting problem, except for the interaction with the bosonic mode. You see what I mean?
Okay, so you
Yeah, so in fact, here, since it turned out that the interaction with the bosonic mode is the most important one, we even dropped the spin index. I mean, we'll put it back in eventually, but for the other reason. But for this dramatic slowdown, we don't really need that. It turns out that the just the interaction with the optical phonons is sufficient to explain why the observed rate is okay. So anyway, to analyze that, you just do a Fermi's golden rule. It's very simple. Again, but it's all simple things. Obviously, it has been done before. So the only trick is that the initial and final states, they correspond to different conformation of the lattice, and therefore you have to use different wave functions for the phonons. And in fact, the overlap of those is precisely what is giving rise to the, or smallness of this overlap gives rise to the slowdown in the tunneling. And you can show that for the elastic tunneling, namely the ones where processes where electrons tunnel without exciting any real phonons, there is an exponential slowdown which goes as the e to minus polaron shift relative to the phonon frequency. And the polaron shift we can estimate given parameters of silicon oxide, since we know the low frequency dielectric constant, high frequency dielectric constant. We assume that the radius of this defect, Bohr radius, is order of angstrom, and then we get that this polaron shift is in fact huge. It's an electron volt. The optical phonons in the bulk are 60 millivolts, so near the interface, if we assume roughly the same, then we get that the slowdown can be on the order of, many orders of magnitude. and that really puts us from this atomically fast timescales down to those human timescales which are actually observed in the experiment. So qualitatively we can claim that this behavior can be understood.
The variables in the Hamiltonian, how large is G compared to omega zero? So G in the previous...
In the Hamiltonian. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, if you want to express this, let me be careful. So this the Poisson shift goes as g squared. So it's basically force over 2k, roughly. Okay. So on the other hand, omega zero. It's this guy. So in principle, they don't need to be parametrically related. So I think G for this particular situation turns out to be smaller than frequency. But I don't think that matters, really.
Yeah, the G were larger than omega zero, I think. People sometimes define the dimensionless electron phonon coupling in these Einstein models as G over omega zero. If that's less than one, but that's quite reasonable.
So here what we claim is that the relevant regime is when this epsilon p by omega zero is greater than one. So we can do it later and see what this corresponds to. Okay, so that seems to work quite nicely. In fact, curiously enough, if you look at Gallium-Arsenide, the system is much less polar. I mean, if you take gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide, so you don't expect this kind of normalizations, and so maybe that's the reason that the gallium arsenide device are less noisy, and in other ways better than.
If you press it far, I can numbers, or it's because it's interface.
And so here, in fact, we put all the bulk numbers. So at the interface, you would expect that it should be something more intermediate between silicon oxide and silicon. So meaning that the electron-phonon interaction not as strong, and frequency could shift either way. So this is really, so what we are saying here is that, okay, we know the defect is sitting in the oxide, so we'll just use oxide parameters. So which is a bit of a stretch, since if it is just 5-10 angstroms away from the interface, there could be some issues with screening and such. But we, for the qualitative estimate, I think it's fine. If you wanted really to put numbers into it, it would be more tricky.
So the conclusion of the resulting coming rate is much slower than the polarization rate, which is why
That's right. Yeah, precisely. So the tunneling, the charge rate which is observed, which is seconds, milliseconds, is really slow. But it doesn't really mean, since there is this additional phonon physics, it does mean that the spin relaxation, for example, the same Karinga, having to do with scattering off of channel electrons, has to be slow. And in fact, this shows up in the other interesting experiment that Jiang did, having to do with the magnetic field dependence of the trap occupancy. So first of all, what's one would expect? So again, we have channel, we have this spin split levels, and so now let's apply a magnetic field. So what do we expect? We expect that as this spin-up level sinks lower and lower down, the probability of its occupancy should increase, because it goes as essentially chemical E to, you know what I mean. It's E to minus energy plus chemical potential divided by temperature. Okay, and so you compare basically two possibilities, that it's empty and that it's full. Compare Gibbs free energies. So that's the behavior that you would expect. In the actual experiments, the situation at high temperatures, in fact, seems to be explained quite well, at least closely enough by this kind of expression. However, if you go to lower temperatures, then you see that essentially experiment really strongly deviates from the theoretical prediction. So what is shown here is the KBT of log of time empty to time full, which is log of that expression. And there's some smoothening because some hyperbolic cosines. it doesn't matter. So let's just focus on high magnetic field behavior. So if you go to 0.4 degrees, it's even more dramatic. Essentially, it looks as if the magnetic field dependence has been eliminated, as if we somehow quenched the spin. Okay? So in condensed matter, we know one effect or one possibility how this can happen, and this can happen through Kondo effect. Okay, but how can we guess? Well, first of all, I'm not sure how people are familiar with Kondo, so let me just, in 30 seconds, go through what it is. So it has been first observed in bulk metals. I'm not sure which one first, perhaps copper. And it has been detected as a low-temperature anomaly where resistivity, which is supposed to typically just go down, starts rising logarithmically with temperature at low enough temperatures. And it was explained by Kondo by invoking higher-order processes of electron scattering on the spin, which are singular at low temperatures. Now, later, through exact solutions and such, it was understood that this resistivity enhancement is happening due to a formation of a singlet between the local spin and the conduction electrons. Okay, and that leads to resonance scattering, and that leads to increase in resistivity. So can something like this happen in our case? It is known that Kondo temperature goes roughly like this. It's an exponential of the Coulomb energy. So if you write down Anderson model, there is Coulomb energy involved, and then there is a tunneling rate, which is involved. And the Kondo temperature goes as exponential of minus the ratio of Coulomb to gamma. Now, in our case, the gamma is tiny, essentially non-existent. It's in the relevant units, it's in the millisecond range, or second range, while all the sort of conventional gamma saying that we encounter, let's say, in magnetic alloys would be perhaps in terahertz range or higher. So based on that, and since Coulomb, I mean, it's always Coulomb, it's always electron volt, you you couldn't get any reasonable Kondo temperature from for our system, naively. Okay? So how do we go around that? So the answer appears to be that the gamma that we observe is this renormalized gamma, which corresponds to real charge processes. So when we transfer electron from the channel on the defect, lattice relaxes, it takes some time, and as a result, the tunneling rate becomes very slow. However, it turns out that for the Kondo physics, in fact, we don't really care that much about the actual charge transfer, but rather we need to worry about virtual processes, which can be actually much faster. The virtual processes occur on the timescale of inverse Coulomb, inverse U. So if U is larger than the Fonon frequency, then there is no renormalization. So essentially, so this the renormalized rates, and so the claim is, I mean, which can be in fact justified using detailed arguments, that for Kondo it's only the bare tunneling which matters if U is large enough and frequency of the Fonons is slow enough. And okay, so this is a cartoon, so that's the last thing I'm going to show you. That's the only animation, I guess. That's the other reason to show it. So what we have here is a really sort of more precise representation of how this defect looks like. So it has one electron which is sitting down below, and then really it's the second electron which can jump into the trap and out of the trap. And so these are those slow processes. Okay. But in addition to that, when you're in the single occupancy regime, you can have the fast processes which go into this energy level which is not renormalized by the polaron shift. So this is the fast dynamics. And again, it's happening on the timescale of inverse U. So if U is larger than the polaron frequency, polaron cannot adjust, and therefore there is no renormalization of the tunneling rates. And therefore, if we want to calculate Kondo temperature, you would just... the prescription is that you just forget about phonons, calculate what you would get based on the Coulomb interactions and their tunneling rates, and you get your answer. And the answer, therefore, doesn't need to be small. And again, we cannot put precise numbers into that, particularly since it's kind of like in superconductivity. Condo temperature is an exponential function, therefore even tiny scrub in parameters can lead to various different numbers. But nevertheless, at least qualitatively, there is no issue. There is one remaining question, which would be a test of whether this picture, which is not completely conventional, makes sense or not. Namely, if we would go to high enough temperature, all this condo behavior should be eliminated, should be gone. So, for example, even at the lowest temperature, which is supposedly below condo, if we went to high magnetic fields, we should recover free spin behavior for high enough fields. Experimentally, there might be some kink here, but it's not really in any way unambiguous as for how this would continue. So further experiments are clearly would be very desirable. Yes. So at large fields, supposedly, if your field becomes larger than condo temperature, the screening, in the sense of RG, when you do RG for condo, you either stop at temperature, you stop at key, if temperature is high, you stop at temperature. If temperature is low, basically everything stops at KT. If magnetic field is larger than condo temperature, you should stop, and larger than temperature, you should stop at magnetic field. So essentially, the screening, which kicks in roughly at condo temperature, is never going to occur if your field is strong enough. And then for our system, that would mean that for a large enough field, we should get back to the single free spin physics. But it's hard to say whether it would or would not happen. Okay.
From the view of those graphs, it looks different than what you expect from condo, because at small fields, you still have linear dependent, but at higher temperature, it always saturates.
Well, okay, so the air bars are quite large, so in principle you can draw various different lines through here, and that's what was done apparently on the top plot. But I guess...
It's radically from one plot to the other, it looks like that. The
you mean that first it's like this, then it's like that, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, here I would really... I would argue that that's not really... I think air bars are sufficiently... not to be able to precisely say, you know, there is some kind of deflection point or inflections. So, I mean, qualitatively, the obvious part of the trend is that the magnetic field dependence becomes really weak. Whether it's condo or not, I don't know. So that's the simplest thing we could come up with. If there is something else, I don't know. I would be really, really curious. Because, I mean, clearly we don't understand system, at least not perfectly, because the fact that the resonance is a switching sign, it's also another curious feature which is which avoids our understanding. This low temperature behavior could be related, could be not. So at least that's the only explanation that we could come up with. So this is it. So this is basically just a summary. So the curious thing is that there are a couple of surprises. One is that there is this inversion, and the other is that there is possibility of condo, but we cannot be sure at this point. So if there are some other explanations, that would be very interesting. So thank you for your attention. Ruger, well, the hope is that, yeah. Well, that's the next frontier. Because it's not that bad, in fact. I mean, we collaborate, actually, not directly with Ruger, but with Chris Hamill, who is sort of competitor or collaborator in sort of in a more broad sense. And indeed, so single electron is there, so single nucleus is... Well, me personally, no, but... my collaborators, yeah, possibly. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think is the range of condo temperatures that would be accessible in this kind of experiment?
Well, again, it's kind of hard to estimate, but there is no reason why the system should be... Well, in principle, if you think about sort of engineering those defects, and again, electrostatically measuring them out, you can control Coulomb. I mean, if you can control the size of the orbital, meaning the depth of the level relative to chemical potential, and you can, as a matter of principle, control the tunneling rate by looking at defects which are located different distances away. So I think the... Although, I mean... No, I think it can be. So, I mean, the curious thing about this regime is that it is kind of like a strange combination of mixed valence regime having to do with this Polaron slowdown and the straight condo. So, as far as straight condo is concerned, the bare tunneling rate can be pretty much anything. I mean, you don't want it to be, I mean, you don't want this defect to be really perhaps in the channel, because then it would be probably harder to study it by doing those transport measurements. But within some reasonable range, it's probably only a few angstroms, 10 angstroms. So you have certain degree of control over the tunneling rate. And since for condo temperature, you really care about the ratio of the Coulomb to tunneling, I think it's a broad range of parameters as a matter of principle. So one could imagine doing, let's say, more like an ensemble measurement where you would take sort of bigger device, like 2-deck with a bunch of stuff on the side, bunch of defects on the side, and then measuring out the temperature dependence over the state, because then you clearly amplify your signal. Well, on the other hand, you have clearly distribution of quantum temperature, so you could expect, like in heavy fermions, I guess, like some people believe, a distribution of quantum temperatures leading to a non-Fermi liquid behavior at low temperatures, etc. So one could play all those games, and I think the variability in parameters can be significant.
All of the experiments being done on a single device?
No. There is more than one, for sure.
See distribution and depths of
the... They see clearly various traps which are either faster or slower. Even sometimes, I guess, on the same device you can get switching, which is happening either on a millisecond or a second range or slower. For the sort of the production device, I guess it was the single one, and it was chosen because the switching rate was very fast. I mean, milliseconds. So it was fast enough to accumulate good statistics, but still slow enough for your measurement apparatus to resolve all the switching behavior.